You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to New Books in Film, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name is Dan Moran. I co-host another podcast, 15-Minute Film Fanatics, but I'm thrilled to be here today for more than 15 minutes with John Krampner, author of Ernest Lehman, The Sweet Smell of Success, just published this month in 2022 by Kentucky University Press. Welcome, John.
Thank you very much, Dan. It's good to be here.
Thanks for coming on the show. Before we get to your book, which I read in a weekend, which I thought was spectacular, which I am now bugging all of my friends to read, before we get to your terrific book and the life and career of Ernest Lehman, could you tell our readers a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I'm from Brooklyn originally. And when I was going to elementary school, they had a series of books called the Orange Books, which were short biographies of leading American figures. I really just, you know, ate up as many of those as I could. And then I just sort of, you know, forgot about it. I went to journalism school in the mid-70s at the University of Wisconsin. When I graduated, I spent the Carter administration getting fired from small-town newspapers across the West, and it was a miserable experience. But the one thing that I learned from that is that the articles that I most enjoyed doing were personal profiles, and I knew I wanted to be an author, and I just said inductively, what's the book-length equivalent of a personal profile? It's a biography. So I came back to Los Angeles really in about 1980. I went to college here in the early 70s. And I wound up teaching English as a second language in adult school for 27 years. And I used that as the basis for writing my, I like to think, reasonably good but non-best-selling books, a biography of live television producer Fred Coe, stage actress Kim Stanley, A History of Peanut Butter, and now Ernest Lehman.
That's great. So it's so funny how you came to these different projects. And let's talk about how you came to this one. So at the end of your book, you're describing Lehman's funeral, and you quote the writer Mel Shavelson saying, quote, "The problem with the sweet smell of success is that it doesn't last beyond our lifetime." But you know, the films that Ernest Lehman wrote, they certainly do last beyond his lifetime and certainly are great artistic successes. So in your preface, you tell this story about how you came to Lehman as the subject of your new book. So can you share that story with the readers?
Oh, absolutely. December of 2000, the New York Times Arts and Leisure section did an article on a very long, meaty feature article on the artistry of the film One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which has nothing to do with Lehman. But I read it, and it irritated me because it didn't mention the screenwriter. I said, how can you do this long article about the artistry of a film and not even mention the screenwriter? And you know, I'm not a screenwriter. I'm just a writer. So I wrote a short, crabby letter to the editor of the Arts and Leisure section. They ran it. And a little while later, I got a letter from Lehman. It says, thank you so much for doing that. I'm so proud of you. This is the fight I've been fighting for my whole career. And so I wandered into the hallway of my apartment, and I looked at my poster for the 1966 re-release of North by Northwest, and I said, yep, same guy. So I went back to my desk. I looked at his letter. He included his phone number. So I called him. I said, thank you so much for your letter. And by the way, would you autograph my poster? So he said, yeah. So I went out to his house in Brentwood on the west side of Los Angeles. We talked a little. The main thing I remember about his house is this huge antenna on his lawn because he was a ham radio buff. So we talked a little. He signed my poster. I used the bathroom and I left. Well, anyway, just a few years ago when I was trying to decide the subject for my next book, and I thought, well, okay, this time I'll do a literary biography. And since I live one zip code away from Hollywood, so that I'll do a screenwriter. So I was going to do a man named Jules Furthman, who he wrote the screenplays for several, Bogart films. I thought, okay, I'll do that. So I go to the library of the Motion Picture Academy, and I request the Jules Furthman biography file. And when it comes, I look at it and I say, it looks very small and it doesn't weigh very much. And so I take the file and I go to one of the tables and I open it. It consists of 2 1-inch obituaries for Furthman. And of course, at this point, there's no one around who knew him. I said, this isn't going to work. But while I was looking into Furthman, I ordered a book on it was a series of capsule biography of screenwriters. It falls open to Ernest Lehman. I say, I know that guy. And I was off to the races.
Wow. That's such a great story that he actually said, come on over and autograph the poster. That's so terrific.
Well, he didn't volunteer. I said, hey, I want to come over and do this. He said, yeah, all right.
So something I appreciated about your book is that by page 21, he's already written the novella of Sweet Smell of Success. By page 46, I wrote these down, he's made Sabrina with Billy Wilder. By page 52, he's made The King and I with Walter Lang. By page 74, Clifford Odets has adapted Lehman's novel into the film Sweet Smell of Success that we all know and love. And by page 80, he's already working in North by Northwest with Hitchcock. Now, you've read a lot of biographies in your life, so have I. This was striking to me because it was different than the usual, you know, you get two generations first of the subject's background, and then the person's born about 50 pages in. So my question I just have to ask you stylistically is, was this a conscious decision of yours, like to elide or compress all the usual kind of biographical matter we find when we pick up biographies?
Well, it's kind of yes and no, because to me it's not really a conscious thing, but at the same time, you know that people, if they buy the book, it's not because they're interested in Lehman's grandfather, right? Although his grandfather was a very interesting person, actually.
They were pretty interesting, yes.
The But and actually, I wound up, I don't recall if you, I don't know if you recall this or not, but I actually wind up mentioning Lehman in the first paragraph of the book. You know, I really want to kind of to get on with things. Now, having said that, it is important, you know, to do the genealogical workup, to talk about their childhood, their adolescence, their formative influences. But again, like I said, that's not why people buy the book. You want to get the information in there, but you really want to compress it as much as possible. Now, I don't know if this is true of biographies in general, but with mine, the first chapter, it's always the shortest chapter, but it takes the most time to research because, again, you have to do the genealogical workup. You have to spend all this time haunting the dusty basements of libraries, you know, going through these, city directories of, you know, where Lehman lived when he was 8 years old and things like that. But yeah, as you said, you really want to compress it down, let people know what the background is, and then get on with things.
That's really interesting because, of you know, the cover of your book, which is, again, sometimes you can judge a book by its cover because the cover of this book is excellent. Those listeners, when you look it up online, you'll see it's got a great picture of Lehman, and behind him, of course, is the crop duster. So it's, you know, like that's why the readers come into the book is, oh, yeah, he wrote North by Northwest, among other things.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about Lehman as a writer. There's so many great quotations that I underline in this book. Here's one of them. Someone asked Lehman if his other films had been easier to write than Sabrina, and he gave this reply, and I love this. This is a great thing for writing students to hear everywhere. Quote, nothing's easy to write. Come on, a letter isn't easy to write. So I love that. Like, what was writing like for Lehman?
It was pure agony, like it is for most serious writers. It's funny because, you know, for example, like when I write an email, I write it, then I edit it, then I go over it again, and then I send it. And it's just an email, you know. With Lehman, he always had at least four drafts to his screenplays, and sometimes his drafts would have drafts. So he was very meticulous. He was even among perfectionists, he was a perfectionist. You know, there's this one great story on his first movie, Executive Suite. It was produced by John Houseman, directed by Robert Wise. Houseman loved Lehman's script. And so one day the three of them are together and Houseman says to Wise, look, I want to read you this one great scene that Lehman wrote. And Lehman said, oh, don't bother, I'm already rewriting it. And Houseman said to him, you are like a barbarian going at the Hope Diamond with an axe. Get out of here, you know. And just one other anecdote in that regard is in the late 80s and early 90s, really after his screenwriting career, Lehman wrote or co-wrote several Oscar shows. And at least several of them were produced by Sam Goldwyn Jr. And I didn't get to speak with him. He had already died. But I interviewed Goldman's widow, Peggy. And she said to me, a few years after the last Oscar show that they did together, they were all at a party. And Sam Goldwyn said, Lehman got me in a corner and he was still rewriting the show. And this was years after they had done their last show together. So he was just, like I said, a perfectionist among perfectionists.
Yeah, that sense of him in agony comes through. And so it reminded me at one point, there's a famous line where somebody asked Cole Porter, what inspires you? And he said, a call from a producer. And he made it sound like this is just your day job. And Ernest Lehman, he had a lot of calls from producers, but he didn't make it seem like it was fun like Cole Porter did.
No, absolutely not.
So another thing I thought of reading your book was there's a 2002 film adaptation. I don't know if you've ever seen this, written by Charlie Kaufman.
Yeah, I did see it directed years by Spike ago. Jones. I don't remember it too well.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because it's about this writer played by Nicolas Cage struggling to adapt. It's kind of like both based on a true story, but it's fantastic at the same time. He's trying to adapt this really unadaptable, uncinematic book by Susan Orlean, The Orchid Thief, which is a real book. And I kept thinking of that movie when I was reading your book because Nicolas Cage is in agony. He has no idea how to adapt it. And this book is very much about the challenge of doing that. And that, you know, Lehman wrote North by Northwest, but he was also a great adapter. You know, he did these four musicals. He did Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. He did the novel by Victor Canning for Family Plot. So were you able to get a sense of what his like maybe his method or his formula was for writing a successful adaptation?
Yes. In a general way, I would say yes. It was really a multi-part process. The first thing to bear in mind, Lehman was part artist and part businessman. And before he would accept an assignment, he would think long and hard about, you know, whether the project would justify all the millions of dollars that a studio was going to invest. And of course, studios really appreciated that about him. So that was the first thing he would do. Then he would read the novel or attend the play several times and just get a sense of, you know, do I like this? Can I do it? Is it adaptable? Thirdly, he would travel to the locations where he thought the film should be shot. And so, for example, on The Sound of Music, he went to, you know, Salzburg in Austria. On West Side Story, he and Robert Wise went to, you know, what was then some of the gang turf on the West Side Story. And there's this great anecdote, which I have in the book, where Lehman was, again, just doing so much research and taking them to so many places that finally Robert Wise said to him, you know, we are not doing a doctorate on juvenile delinquency. We're doing a movie. We have a lot of good stuff. Let's get going, you know. The also on Somebody Up There Likes Me, the biopic of Rocky Graziano, which made Paul Newman a star. Again, Lehman, you know, went back to New York. He not only went to a lot of the places that were associated with Graziano, but he interviewed him and his wife and people who knew him. And MGM was opposed to Lehman, you know, taking this trip. They said, oh, that's just a waste of money. But in fact, Lehman learned all these biographical details, which really made it such a better film. And fourthly, Lehman, like I said, he would do multiple versions of every screenplay, but he would rework the source material to really make it a better Hollywood film. And again, Robert Wise had this quote. He said that Lehman's screenplays were so good that it caused people to remember the original source material as better than it actually was, you know. And so, for example, sticking with Somebody Up There Likes Me, let's look at some of the stuff that Lehman cut out from Graziano's memoir. One thing Graziano writes about was, and he was a very serious juvenile delinquent. It's amazing he actually became a successful, grown-up, mature adult, you know. But he talks about him and his friends digging up the grave of Peter Stuyvesant, one of the Dutch governors of New York. I guess there was a rumor that there was some valuable stuff buried with him. They dug up his grave. Yeah, that's so gross. And so, you know, Lehman throws that out. Another thing is, still in his juvenile delinquent phase, Graziano was, at one point, the judge that he went before, was Lou Gehrig, after his Pride of the Yankee phase, ALS, you know, he had to quit baseball. But so he was working as a juvenile court judge. And at one point, Graziano came before him and, you know, Gehrig looked at the facts of the case and said, okay, I'm sentencing you back to juvenile hall. And the young Graziano goes, go to hell, Mr. Gehrig. And so again, Lehman didn't include that.
Wow.
And you know, but
there's no way that would be cut. There's no way that would be cut today. That scene would be in there today, absolutely.
Well, the thing is, but it Lehman rightly figured that it would make him just a very unsympathetic figure, you know. And finally, the conclusion of the film is Graziano defeats Tony Zale in this brutal, bloody title match. And so then you have with Graziano and his wife, there's the they ride in the limousine in the parade and all that. What Lehman thoughtfully edits out is in the rematch with Zale, Zale knocked Graziano out. So he really knew how to organize the material to make it a good Hollywood film.
Yeah. And you talk about, that's funny how he organized, like, you know, Rocky Graziano's life, but also how much he toyed with the order of songs in the musicals and rewrote certain things. And I just love, you know, I was reminded of one of your two epigraphs for the book is by Helen M. Strauss. And it says, quote, every screenplay is an original screenplay for all practical purposes. And to transpose beloved works without bruises is a harder task than it seems. So it's not just a matter of like, just now I'll just type the musical onto a new piece of paper and we'll roll.
No, and it's really kind of sad and ironic is that on West Side Story, and I think that's especially what Robert Wise had in mind when he talked about Lehman improving the source material. Lehman moved a number of the songs around. He had Stephen Sondheim rework the lyrics for America, which to me is such a wonderful song. Lehman moved the location to a rooftop because when he interviewed a sort of a probation officer for juvies, he said that's the only place that young kids can go in the ghetto to really to get away from things. So Lehman, he invented new characters for the film. At the same time, he said he wanted to do it in such a way that it would seem as though only the ashtrays had been moved. And sadly, ironically, that's what happened because afterwards, another screenwriter came up to Lehman and said, great typing, Ernie, you know. And but the other part, and this is even worse, is West Side Story was nominated for 11 Oscars. It won 10. The only exception is Lehman's screenplay. So again, obviously the Academy voters thought he just moved the ashtrays around.
Yeah. And none of those 10, as you mentioned in the book, mentioned him in their acceptance speeches.
Oh, right. And that just broke his heart. You know, it's sort of like, A, he didn't win, and B, he wasn't even acknowledged obliquely, and that upset him to no end.
Yeah. Well, one theme of your book, even if somebody read this and hadn't seen any of the films or had no idea who Ernest Lehman was and never saw West Side Story, et cetera, you know, I think a reader could come to this book and say it's about, like, one of the themes is respect for screenwriters, right? Because I got the sense that, you know, Lehman was often irritated, as you must have been when you wrote that letter about Cuckoo's Nest, you know, by these ideas that screenwriters are kind of like the Roddy Dangerfields of a movie production. Like, the director's very, really flashy, and we all know who the leading actors are, and you have these producers, you know, the image of the producer with the big cigar. So there's all these great stories where Lehman tries to, you know, up the respect level for screenwriters. Like, there's that great bit, and I didn't know any of these stories till I read your book. They were so wonderful. There's a part where he's standing watching Hitchcock shoot North by Northwest, and someone says, "Why are you watching Hitchcock shoot his picture?" And Lehman says, "He's not shooting his picture. He's shooting my picture," right? And then he gets the reviews for North by Northwest, and he's like, "They're all Hitchcock all the time." And then later in the book, you come right out and you say this. This is a quotation I want to get your reaction to. You say this regarding the finished cut of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. And this is you, quote, "The attempted erasure of Lehman's major contributions to the film by Edward Albee and Mike Nichols is deplorable."
Yeah, it really was. And what's so annoying is that, you know, both Nichols and Albee are great artists in their own right, but they have to build themselves up further by raining on the Lehman's parade. And what Lehman did to make Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf the successful film that it is, again, his contributions are extensive, but both Nichols and Albee, you know, being the egomaniacs that they were, you know, had to say, "No, it was all us," you know, and that just really offended the hell out of me.
Yeah. And also, it's funny because a lot, you know, the old cliche is, oh, the book's better than the movie, which is not always true. Certainly not true with Hitchcock's career, right? But I've read Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, and I've actually seen, you know, good Actors Equity productions of it after the film, and it's never as good as the film. Like, there's the film was, I think, a marked improvement on the play.
Well, you're not the only person to say that. Several of the reviewers pointed that out as well. And, you know, one thing Lehman said, for example, is that because Albee is such a gifted writer, sometimes the speeches would go on in a way that you can get away with in the theater, but you could not get away with in the movie theater. And so, Lehman added a number of locations, including, you know, the roadhouse scene to open it up. And funnily, is that a word? Anyway, he got into an argument with Elizabeth Taylor, where I guess, you know, she was trying to be the serious intellectual, and she goes, "Oh, the... you know, that roadhouse scene is, you just add that to make it more cinematic." And Lehman said, "Oh, and, that's a very intellectual thing to say." And then Taylor says, "Oh, well, I'm glad you think I'm an intellectual." So they were really mixing it up over that. But Lehman had, other locations, both outside and inside the house to avoid making it just, you know, the play is just purely in the living room. And Lehman knew, you know, you couldn't do that.
Yeah, you couldn't, unless you're going to make rope again or something.
Right.
So we talked about Mike Nichols. Let's talk about different directors, because one of the strengths of your book, one of the many strengths, is that the reader gets a sense of Lehman's relationships with different directors. So I want to kind of throw some out at you and run through them. And if you could talk about his relationship with these different people, because they're all famous big time directors, we'll hear what you have to say about them. So let's start with Billy Wilder, with whom he did Sabrina in 1954.
Well, that was an extremely difficult experience for Lehman, because Wilder, at least on Sabrina, was really improvising. They were they were shooting the film just barely one day ahead of the screenwriting. And Lehman is kind of a high-strung person. He likes to do things way in advance, multiple times. And, he basically actually had a nervous collapse on that film. But he also had a hard time with Wilder because, I think Wilder is just the sort of person who really likes to egg and poke people. And for example, when he learned that Lehman didn't like caviar, he was like, "Oh my God, what's wrong with you? What's the matter?" And then they were both sports fans, but so Wilder asked him, "Who do you, which team do you follow?" Lehman said, "The Yankees." "The Yankees? Only an underdog like you would follow an overdog like the Yankees, you know." Wilder gave Lehman a hard time because Wilder wanted to have a sex scene between Humphrey Bogart and Audrey Hepburn. And Lehman says, "No, this is a fairy tale. You don't have sex scenes in a fairy tale." And Wilder, who, like Lehman, is Jewish, goes, "Oh, you're just a Jewish prude, you know." And like I said, because it was such a difficult experience for Lehman working with Wilder, at one point he actually did have a nervous collapse. His doctor ordered him home to bed rest, but Wilder, being Wilder, snuck into his house and kept working with him. And then one day, while Wilder is there, Lehman's doctor shows up. And so Wilder hides in the closet. And apparently, Lehman's doctor was no dummy. And so he had his session with Lehman. And then as he was leaving, he yells in a stage voice, "You can come out from hiding now, Mr. Wilder."
It was so funny to read all that stuff about Sabrina because I didn't know any of it. So, of course, in my mind, Sabrina is this very light, like you said, fairy tale. And then you read about the making of it and it's like Apocalypse Now or something.
It was a brutal experience.
Brutal.
And also, of course, Humphrey Bogart was the odd man out on that. You know, Billy Wilder would hang out with William Holden and Audrey Hepburn and Lehman. And so so Bogart got very grouchy. And at one point, he just yelled at Lehman, "Get this City College writer out of here." And then Wilder said, "Okay, I'm shutting down production until Bogart apologizes to Lehman."
Yeah, crazy. The tension was unbelievable. So, well, let's go to a nicer relationship. So he moves then, Lehman moves to Hitchcock and North by Northwest. And then later on, they make Hitchcock's final film together, Family Plot. So what was Lehman's relationship like with Hitchcock?
That was more of a mixed bag. On North by Northwest, they got along very well, which is surprising when you consider that they're both control freaks, and but they did get along well. The one exception, though, being when they were rehearsing the crop duster scene in Hitchcock's living room in Bel Air. And apparently Lehman was making so many suggestions that Hitchcock, who never raised his voice, yelled at him, "Why do you insist on telling me how to direct my film?" And Lehman later said, "Well, I should have replied, why do you insist on telling me how to write it?" So right. Now on Family Plot, which was Hitchcock's last film, that was tougher because, Hitchcock was in very poor health. Whereas Lehman was, you know, let's face it, he was a pretty anal guy. And he was like, let's get on with it. Let's do things. And of course, Hitchcock wasn't always able to, you know.
Yeah.
And
it's a very sympathetic portrait you give of Hitchcock at the end.
Yeah. Yeah. And yes. So basically that was kind of a tougher one. And but somehow they did get through it. Yeah.
Yeah. I love the stories about North by Northwest. They made me laugh with Lehman when you could imagine Hitchcock saying, "Okay, we're going to go down. We're going to go down Lincoln's Nose. We're going to be on Mount Rushmore. Make it happen." And Lehman's like, "Okay, all right, sure."
Right. No. It. Well, again, the real challenge for Lehman on North by Northwest was that Hitchcock, as directors tend to do. You know, they think in terms of scenes, and it was actually my mentor, the author Tom Stemple, who pointed this out to me. You know, directors think in terms of scenes. So Hitchcock would come up with all these scenes, and then Lehman had to cobble them together into a plot. And it's really funny because, like, years later, when Lehman was doing a seminar at the University of Texas. And he said to them, "Why on earth would somebody try to escape by running down, you know, Mount Rushmore?" You know, he thought it was kind of a risible thing, but you know, Hitchcock came up with the idea, and it was his job to make it work.
Right. It's like the least inefficient way you could probably kill somebody is to run them over with a crop duster, you know, where there's no crops. But
by the way, on that scene, Hitchcock wanted Cary Grant to be menaced by a tornado.
Right.
And Lehman said to him, "Hitchcock, no matter how evil the Cold War adversaries are, they can't conjure up a tornado on demand." So the crop duster was Lehman's idea.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, it's the next best thing. And it's so funny for what we talked about with adaptations is that what you just said about Lehman having to put scene by scene together is that North by Northwest is regarded as, I think rightly so, as one of the great, great screenplays, but it's like a pure movie. Like you can't imagine reading the novel of North by Northwest. It's a pure cinematic experience. And I love what you said about putting the scenes together, because you could see how Lehman had to put things in the plot like, you know, what does James Mason want? Well, government secrets. It's government secrets. That's the MacGuffin. And it's funny how like it's such a cinematic experience as opposed to an adaptation of something else.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So let's move on. So we talked about Robert Wise before. He directed four of Lehman's screenplays, right? Executive Suite, Somebody Up There Likes Me, and West Side Story and The Sound of Music. You know, you talked a little about him being one of Lehman's favorites. Why did they get along so well?
The number one reason is from an anecdote that Lehman told, where he said, "If I'm doing a screenplay for Robert Wise, I have to be careful to do a good job because I know he's going to film it exactly the way that I wrote it." And so that's what, as a screener, what he loved about him, that Wise didn't think, oh, I'm this creative director who's going to, play paper dolls with the screenplay. So he just revered Wise for that. Another thing that I think he really liked, although he never said so as such, is that Lehman, like I said, was a pretty high-strung guy, whereas Wise was very mellow, hang loose, and unruffled. And so they made a good team that way. And as a matter of fact, Wise had a quote about Lehman's personality where he said, he is meticulous in the extreme, which again is a nice way of saying he's an anal retentive, they got along very well. As a matter of fact, they were going to do a fifth film in the 1980s. There was going to be a remake of Zorba the Greek with Anthony Quinn and John Travolta as the young protege, but unfortunately the studio canon fell apart. And they were also friends, Lehman and Wise. They and a couple of other Hollywood people, they would every year or so they would kind of go to one of these tiki luau restaurants on the west side and just have lunch and stuff like that. But no, he just revered Wise.
Yeah, that's great. You get a sense of their camaraderie. So after that, he goes from this, pretty successful collegial relationship, with other directors to Mike Nichols. And we mentioned Mike Nichols before. His ego comes out very, very strong in your chapter of Virginia Woolf, which I thought was almost like a standalone tour de force, because I thought I knew a lot about the making of that film. And then I read your book, so I was happy to learn so much. You talked about the tension with there, but one of the things that occurred to me is that the making of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf was almost like, in ways, the actual story and what happens with George and Martha in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. And there's all this tension, but one image I just want to get your reaction to that I love so much is you have this image for the reader of Lehman and Richard Burton. They hit it off and they're playing ping pong. I just love that image of those two playing ping pong. So can you talk about like Lehman trying to produce this film and trying to keep everybody? It seemed like it was hurting not just cats, but like feral cats.
that's an excellent way of putting it, believe me. Let's start with Richard Burton, because that was kind of the high point of the film for Lehman. When they went on location to Smith College in Massachusetts, and one day it was like an off day, so they were just having a cast and crew party. And yeah, Lehman was playing ping pong with Burton, and he said, Burton is just as good a ping pong player as he is an actor. He got off some fantastic shots. But the sport, of course, that Lehman and Burton really bonded over was baseball. Richard Burton was the rare Welshman who was a fan of American baseball. He would carry around a transistor radio to keep up with the Dodgers. Lehman was impressed with the fact that he not only knew who Ty Cobb was, but had seen him play in an old-timers game at Yankee Stadium. But again, as you say, feral cats is such a perfect analogy there. And especially the Mike Nichols, there's really no other way to put it. He was just sort of like a bully. He really bullied Lehman. Yeah. And I was really angry at Nichols, but I was angry at Lehman too, because this was Nichols' first film. He was only doing about his third play on Broadway right then. Lehman was well established in Hollywood. And the fact that he failed to put his foot down is just a real character shortcoming of his. But again, to me, the quote that really sums it all up, I did get to speak with George Siegel. And he said, look, there was a lot of tension on the set, but the movie is about bad interpersonal relations. So that kind of, in a sense, that kind of helped the film.
Everybody became a method actor.
In a sense, yes.
There's that great line in your book too. I love this, made me laugh out loud, as you go through all the tension with that. And you just quote somebody on the lighting crew who says, you know, the next movie I'm doing like an Elvis picture.
Well, it's, again, this can be true of great art in general, where it digs so deeply into the human condition and all the things that can make life the harrowing experience it sometimes is, that sometimes afterwards, yeah, you want to watch an Elvis film. You want to do something that's mediocre but reassuring.
Yeah. And it's funny from reading your book is that I would assume if someone said to me, you know, the set of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf was really, really tense, that would make sense, because you watch it and you think to yourself, well, this doesn't look like it was a particularly fun movie to make. But I would assume that Sabrina was a lot of fun to make. You're with William Holden and Bogart, Audrey Hepburn. And then, of course, you go behind the scenes on that as well.
No, again, yeah, it's and Lehman had a quote at some point to the effect of what you're saying, which is that it's a pleasant movie to watch, but it was not a pleasant movie to make or to live.
Right. Yeah, to live, right? And Lehman carried this chip on his shoulder about Mike Nichols, like, for the rest of his life, right?
Absolutely. The 6 or 7 years later, when he was making Portnoy's Complaint, his one bomb, Lee Grant, who was plays Portnoy's mother, she said the first thing that Lehman said to him was nothing about Portnoy. It was about, I hate Mike Nichols, and however long it takes, I'm going to get him. And then, like 35 years later, when you know, Lehman's an old guy, about 2000 or so, and he took his journal to this glossy magazine, and they excerpted a part which, in effect, you know, runs Nichols down. He was still, you know, fighting that fight. And by the way, it's my theory. I've never seen this anywhere else, but Virginia Woolf is really a watershed in Lehman's career. Before that, he makes 11 films in 10 years. They're critically and commercially esteemed. After that, he makes like 4 films in 13 years. 3 of them are so-so. One of them is no good. And it's kind of my theory that he was so emotionally brutalized by Nichols on that experience that it somehow broke something inside of him. I may be over extrapolating here, but I don't think so.
Well, he went from Nichols, who was his own problems. Then he goes to Gene Kelly to make Hello, Dolly. And there's more bickering. This bickering is a little lighter in the book than the tension of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. But all the bickering between Barbara Streisand and Walter Matthau. So can you talk about that? And you also have this great story where Gene Kelly tells Ernest Lehman in a non-polite terms why he shouldn't talk to his actors.
Right. The well, to start with, you know, Kelly versus Lehman, on Hello, Dolly, Lehman was both the screenwriter and the producer. So I guess he felt he had a certain amount of right to say so. Kelly, on the other hand, felt, well, I'm the director and you don't have any right to say so. And so one day he caught Lehman talking to one of the actors and making some suggestions. And if I remember this correctly, Kelly said to Lehman, if I catch you, giving acting tips to any of my actors again, I'll bust you in the mouth, you know. But Lehman was less preoccupied with that than he was with the, it was really kind of a war between Barbara Streisand and Walter Matthau. And I had a really good interview with Richard Cobrett, who was the uncredited unit production manager on that film. And he said, you know, I think more of the fault in that fight was with Matthau. You know, you'd assume it would be Streisand. But he said, no, he was kind of old world, and I guess he didn't like co-starring with this young woman. And so, but Matthau was, and he was rough on Streisand, of course, you know, she knew how to give it back. But at one point he said to her, you know, I think this is the first movie I've been on where I'm better looking than the leading lady. And, she said, like, you know, go to hell or go bleed.
She called
herself.
Him an a-hole. Yeah, she called him an a-hole after that, right, in front of everybody.
And
yeah.
So then they had to stop filming so they could take them off to the side so they could yell at each other. And also, Cobritz told me this story where one day, this is when they were on location in Garrison, which is in the Hudson River Highlands in New York. And Matthau's ancient old country mother was visiting them. And so Matthau and his mother are walking down the street one way and Streisand's coming the other. And about when they pass, Matthau's mother said to to Streisand, why are you so mean to my son? You know, so she was getting it with both barrels.
Yeah, he comes across as Walter, like Walter Matthau-esque off screen, because you know you get the sense that he didn't like, she was 25, he didn't know what he was doing there necessarily, and Gene Kelly had to keep his ship floating ahead.
Absolutely.
So from there, you mentioned his one bomb. Lehman goes to his one disaster, which is his adaptation, which he also directed, of Portnoy's Complaint. Now, that came out in 1972. And you mentioned in the book that this is a huge novel. Everyone knows the novel. Everyone knows Philip Roth. But this is such a low point in his career that you mentioned in the book that even now, Richard Benjamin, you know, who's cast as the lead in the film, he wouldn't even talk to you about it.
Right.
So can tell the story about that film.
Yeah, I'm sorry. With Richard Benjamin, I really did pursue him, and to his credit, he was polite, but you know, as I mentioned in the book, I really got the impression that you know he would rather have a root canal without anesthesia than relive his experiences on Portnoy again. I guess it was just such an embarrassment for him, as well as such an unpleasant experience. Part of the problem was, of course, that on that one, you know, Lehman had produced several films at this point. You know, he produced Hello, Dolly, he'd produced Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, and he thought, you know, I became the producer so I could have more control over the film, but then the director took control. I know what I'll do. I will be the producer, director, writer. I will do everything. And unfortunately, to use a vulgar admonition that Robin Williams used one year at the Academy Awards, the writer, producer, director is the only creature who can blow smoke up his own ass. In other words, there was nobody to tell him when he was going off the rails, you know. And so the question is, why could such a successful screenwriter as Lehman produce such a calamity? And, you know, part of it is, you know what we just said about the triple hyphenate. Also, Lehman's wife, Jackie, said she thought that he just wanted to try and prove that he could do the impossible. And sometimes he could, but this time he couldn't. And it's my theory also. Lehman was a non-practicing Jew. And I think that the film could have been made better either by an observant Jew, or, as odd as this may sound, I think even an anti-Semite could have made a better version of Portnoy than Lehman did, because at least an anti-Semite would have strong feelings about Judaism, whereas Lehman, I think, was just largely indifferent to it.
Yeah, it was such with the world of literature and theater at his fingertips. It struck me as such an odd choice that that's what he wanted to do. Like it was like you wanted to make a film of a Thomas Pynchon novel or something. Like Portnoy's Complaint is so uncinematic. Like nobody reads Portnoy's Complaint and says this would be a good movie.
Right. It was what Lehman's wife Jackie said. He wanted to prove he could do the impossible, but he couldn't. Right.
But he couldn't. And it was so funny that you said Richard Benjamin wouldn't even say something like, yeah, you know, we did our best. It was the early 70s. We thought it would work. It was just like, nope, like we're never opening that vault of memories again.
Right. Well, it's funny because I did use a quote from the film editor. I didn't speak with him, but I read his memoir. And in his book, the film editor was asked, well, tell me about Portnoy, because he worked on that film too. And he said, oh, I just can't. You know, it's just this, it's like this horror movie for all these people.
So we've talked a lot about his writing and his work with directors. And I want to finish by talking about Lehman's personality, because I knew nothing about his personality until I read your book. And you're so good, I think, at portraying his triumphs and his insecurities. You're very sharp at that. And throughout the book, and you mentioned it at the beginning of this interview, you mentioned his hobby of ham radio and that he would be up all night trying to play with his ham radio and communicate with people physically far away from him. But at the same time, he seemed to have this problem communicating with people who are right in front of him and parts of his family. Like, is that accurate? Like, what do you make of the ham radio hobby?
That's very accurate. As a matter of fact, his good friend, the screenwriter, Mel Shavelson, when he was doing Lehman's eulogy at his memorial service, and he brought up the ham radio hobby, which they both shared. And Shavelson said, there's something about the thrill of amateur radio that makes it increasingly enjoyable to talk to your friends the further they are away from you. And then he added, there may be a deeper meaning here, but let's not go into that. And Lehman would, this just astonished me, Lehman's younger adult son, Alan, provided me with the Lehman's wife, Jackie, was just a noted Hollywood hostess, and she kept a journal of all the dinner parties she held. And I was looking through them, and at one of them, it was a small dinner party, about six or eight people, Lehman's and Jackie's closest friends. And she writes in the margin, midway through, Ernie leaves and goes up to talk on his ham radio. And I'm like, what the hell? So he just, it's like some people are less, the closer people are, the less comfortable that you are with them. And I guess he was one of them.
Yeah, his personality, it was so funny. His personality reminded me so much of like the opposite or the antithesis of someone like John Huston.
Certainly the opposite of his, like his close friend, David Brown, the producer. You know, David Brown was like the quintessence of the bon vivant and the extrovert. And yet they were friends for 80 years. They met when they were 9 years old in Woodmere, Long Island. You know,
Yeah. So it's a great portrait of a real, you know, flesh and blood human being who produced some great, great movies and directed some great movies and directed one poor movie, but wrote a lot of great movies as well. So John, it's been great talking to you today. I cannot urge your book upon people strongly enough. I think everybody should get a copy of it. I'm not just saying that because we're having this conversation. I really, really enjoyed it. The book, again, is called Ernest Lehman, The Sweet Smell of Success. It's a great, great read. It's just published. Thank you so much for the conversation, John.
Thank you so much, Dan. It's a pleasure to speak with you.